Culture and Rural Development Committee will come to order for Wednesday, March 20th. Thank you, members. We have a pretty full agenda, and we'd like to get through this by 5:30. So with that, I would ask Senator Jensen to come forward on Senate File 1073. Senator Jensen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am here today to move Senate File 1073. It deals with the statutes in Chapter 239, Weights and Measures. What this bill does is it clarifies Minnesota Statute 239 on sales from bulk to also apply to petroleum products and fuels. It allows the department to resolve complaints when a consumer does not receive mandate-compliant fuel. It also clarifies existing law by utilizing delivery ticket for fuels containing disclosure information for gas that includes octane rating and the percentage of alternative fuels blended, and for diesel, it must contain the grade of diesel and the biodiesel content. It brings Minnesota state current with the rest of the country, with technical updates to bring into compliance with the most recent ASTM standards. Currently, there are 2008 ASTM standards, and this would bring it up to at least, in most cases, 2011 standards. To allow Weights and Measures to take action in situations where gasoline is sold from the same tank for different prices and updated to include identical product pricing. And finally, this bill strengthens consumer protections by ensuring minimum octane rating for retail gasoline sales. I have with me today Peter Brickwitty, and he is from the Department of Commerce, and he can talk about the specific sections of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Mr. Brickwitty, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thanks very much for the opportunity. Again, I'm Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Wanted to say thank you to Senator Jensen for carrying the department's Weights and Measures bill. I do want to note for the committee, and I spoke to Mr. Martinson right before committee about this, I believe there's a typo on page 3, line 27 in the ASTM specification. Right now on that line, it reads ASTM specification D675-11B. I believe it should be D6751. It's referenced later in the bill on line 412 correctly, and I believe that's just a typo that we could correct. And indicative of the type of technical corrections that we're making in this bill, Mr. Chair, we have been working with folks from the Petroleum Marketers Association and Flint Hills. We worked out quite amicably a couple of technical amendments that were put on in the Commerce Committee, which heard this bill on Monday. As Senator Jensen outlined, in addition to the technical updates, there are some clarifications regarding Weights and Measures enforcement capability, some language relating to identical pricing of products that come out of one tank, and it sets a minimum octane rating for retail gasoline sales in the state of Minnesota, which we believe is a strong consumer protection. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. And I just want to take the opportunity to, I know that Mr. Knopf is taking a look at it, and I want to thank our staff, because I know that during deadlines, these men and women are working very hard trying to get a lot of paper and language straightened out for us. So I think, Mr. Knopf, if you're ready, we can take a look at those changes.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I think the change would be on 3.27. I mean, what we'll do is we're going to delete the D675-11B and insert D6751-11B. And that would be consistent with the on page 4, on page 4, line 7. No, wait a minute, that's not page 4, line 12. And that would be consistent to the same standard that we've used there.
And Senator Jensen and Mr. Brickwitty, that's the correction you'd like?
Yes, members understand.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Someone could make a motion for me.
Senator Schmidt will make the oral amendment to change line 3.27 and 4.12. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Members, any discussion, or would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1073? If not, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 1073, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Next, we have Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 240, a jobs training bill. Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Always nice to be in front of you. And, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for accommodating my witness who has a time crunch here, and so from Cloquet and has a long ways to go. Members, I think there's an amendment, Mr. Chairman, that a one amendment that I think it's technical in nature, isn't it?
Absolutely. Okay. And council says it is absolutely technical. So Senator Bonoff will move the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Tomasoni, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Senate File 240 is the Greater Minnesota Jobs Training Program helps with one of the most common problems facing Greater Minnesota businesses, the lack of a well-trained workforce to fill jobs that are available. Minnesotans currently have several opportunities for greater job training through an on-the-job training, private instructors, MinSCU instructions, the University of Minnesota, and private colleges. The issue most Minnesotans face is an inability to pay, along with a lack of flexibility and adaptability within the training. The Greater Minnesota Job Training Tax Credit helps reduce the cost for both employees and employers by providing training funding for specific jobs and businesses that meet the qualifications. It is different from other programs in that it provides targeted training specific to a business's need for as few as one new employee. To qualify for job training funding, a business must be expanding or locating in Minnesota for the first time and must be located outside of the metropolitan area. DEED approves the new job cost and training method that the employer will use and verifies that no other training program fits the employer's needs. The mechanics of the program are simple. Once a contract is signed between DEED and the employer pays for the training. The employer is then reimbursed for the cost of the training as new employee tax withholdings accrue, either with a grant from DEED or a tax credit from the Department of Revenue. The credit or grant is funded through the tax withholdings of the new employees. Essentially, new revenue pays for the training. After that, the state receives the benefits of the new employees. If the employee quits or the business closes, no more credits or grants from the withholdings may be offered. So I have Mike Miller from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities here to discuss the technical aspects of the bill. And I don't know if you want to go now, or do you want to have Bruce go first?
I can go first.
Okay.
Mr. Miller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill is, it's not an original concept. It's a concept that we heard from our cities in Greater Minnesota. They're using in Iowa and North Dakota to grow jobs. And essentially what happens is a business hires five new people. Five is just a number I'm throwing out. They bring them on board and realize that maybe they're not necessarily trained for the exact specifications of the job. This allows them to go to DEED and say, we've got these new employees, we want to train them. Do you have a training program? DEED kind of flips through the Rolodex and says, you know, we really don't have a program to train these employees. Why don't you do it yourself? The business can then train them through on-the-job training, bringing in a private instructor or contracting with a MinSCU or University of Minnesota or private college instructor to get the training done. At that point, the tax revenue from the newly hired employees, and they have to be newly hired employees in new jobs, is collected into one pot, and the business is reimbursed for the training cost. After the business has been reimbursed to the full extent of the cost or 10 years of tax withholdings from the new employees, it stops, the state starts to collect the tax revenue. It's actually a fairly simple concept, and we would appreciate your support.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. Mayor, thank you for making the trip down today. How's everything in Cloquet?
Cold, windy. That ain't much different than down here. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Just please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony whenever you're ready.
Bruce Algren. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Algren, mayor of the city of Cloquet. We're just about 17, 18 miles south of Duluth and I-35 and home to the Sappy Paper Mill, a business with a long history of providing jobs to our community. The world has changed. Employees in their 40s who were trained 20 years ago may no longer be suitable for jobs that are available due to the technical advantages. We must consider an option for making sure that good-paying jobs with benefits are available to them. This bill creates a vehicle for the Sappy Mill to train small numbers of employees within the facility and when they are making small expansions. And they are making a small expansion, a renovation of about $170 million as we speak. Rural cities and towns need new, unique options to create long, strong, viable workforce. Without new programs like this legislation, our businesses cannot expand because we simply do not have the population to another person just around the corner. We need to create and develop our workforce and to to complete global and locally, compete. The state should do anything it can to increase job numbers. This program is paid by the tax withholdings of the employees. It is unique and creative thinking that encourages rewards businesses who want to grow and develop Minnesota workforce. To me, we need a more economic development programs that are specific to the economy of greater Minnesota. We have seen many economic development programs and promotions within the Twin Cities, from light rail lines to stadiums. We need to make sure that the Minnesota growth, economic growth, is evenly split between the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota. This is a small task that will pay great dividends down the road. Thank you very much.
Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for your testimony. I couldn't agree with you more. Sir, would you like to testify?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Harold Stanislawski. I'm the Executive Director of the Fergus Falls Economic Improvement Commission. As you know, Fergus Falls is a growing community west of Alexandria on I-94. One of the greatest economic challenges facing greater Minnesota is the lack of trained employees for jobs that businesses want to hire. Without trained employees, businesses can't expand, and most businesses coming out of recession may not have the revenue to pay for the training as well as wages. The economy has changed. All jobs are more technical, they require more precision, and have evolved and changed dramatically over the last 20 years. This bill allows the taxes of the new employee to pay for the training, allowing the businesses to focus on quality of training and good wages. There are no one-size-fits-all programs, and this is an ideal program for a small expansion that maybe only requires 3 months of training. It is a unique system that gets to the employers who fall through the cracks, hiring too many people to find trained applicants, but too few for existing programs like the Job Skills Partnership. If Deed sees fit, this program is flexible enough even for a larger training program. North Dakota and Iowa are using this, and we need this in order to compete. Fergus Falls is a little unique. We're very close to the North Dakota border, where that state is booming. We certainly could use these tools to compete. We know we can't match them on everything, but we need to make Minnesota a more appealing option for the future. Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce one of my manufacturing businesses that came, Anthony Hicks, who represents Green Plains Energy in Fergus Falls.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Hicks, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Obviously, I don't need to introduce myself. Harold did that. I just want to offer my support for this program. We're always in need of new employees in our region, and every employee has to go through a learning period, and obviously that can be costly on both parties. But I think, you know, you've heard more than once about the specific needs, but most jobs today are becoming more and more specialized, and this would obviously give an opportunity, you know, for both parties to learn, and for a new employee to show the skill sets that they actually have, and allows the time for both to evaluate how they're doing. Local retention is a big factor, and we have found in our business that if we can train somebody that is from our community, the tendency to stay is much greater. And with that length of service comes a lot more factors than just their skill sets. You know, they become safer at their duties around the plants. So we encourage wherever we possibly can to hire locally. On the job training, you know, we've used that before in our case, certainly with Minscu, and we find that those programs are very beneficial in working with our employees and training them to our specific needs. So again, this program would obviously offer to encompass many of the services that we have locally. Confidence would be, you know, another area that I'd like to address, you know, and this helps both the employer and the employee. You know, if the employee doesn't have the skill sets that match our particular needs, then we can demonstrate that we have the skills and the time to promote and train them. And finally, I'd just like to mention, you know, you hear a lot about just-in-time inventory, and employers are no different than, you know, with their employees. You know, we don't take on board people unless we have a need, and often that need is imminent. And so I think, you know, this would allow us to do expansion and get people trained prior to establishing the need. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your time and allow you to move on.
Mr. Hicks, thank you for your testimony. And this committee has worked very hard this entire session working on jobs and job creation. And I know that Senator Tomasoni and his Environment, Economic Development, Ag Budget Division is very focused on that, too. So thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony and support of this legislation. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 240? Do members have any questions for Senator Tomasoni? Senator Dames.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Senator Tomasoni, just a couple of questions. First of all, I think you're bringing a really good bill for rural Minnesota. I do have a couple of questions. A $13 an hour, how was that number arrived at?
Mr. Miller, or Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Miller? Chair, Senator Dames, that is 175% of federal poverty for a family of four.
Senator Dames.
Thank you. Follow-up. I believe the Economic Development Director from Fergus Falls mentioned that South Dakota and Iowa both have this program. Can you tell me what their hourly rate is for their program?
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, I cannot. I'm not 100% sure what it is.
Senator Dames.
Follow-up. Senator Tomasoni, it's the cost of this program is projected to be $10 million a year. Do you know how many how much of that, what percent of that is going for administration, and what percent of that will actually be going for training?
Senator Tomasoni,
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Dames, the intent here is that that this money is going to be generated by the fact of the matter that the person is being employed and through the taxes that the person is paying. And depending, I would assume, depending upon the job skill that's necessary and the ability of the employee that is needing the job training, it's going to be different for each employee. I've heard numbers from $1,000 to $4,000, so I think there's a wide range of what could possibly be the cost. But based on what I've been hearing in this. Coming out of the recession economy, there's as many as 60,000 very good-paying jobs open around the state, but there aren't the trained employees to fill the jobs. And this is exactly the type of program that I think will work really well toward filling those job openings, because the company themselves will be doing the on-the-job training and using the educational system that is probably in a nearby town to benefit their instruction, and the cost will be paid for by the program itself.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
just to follow up, I understand what you're saying. Will this program, is this program going to be administered and managed by deed?
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, yes, it will be. And in the bill, there is a provision for up to a $500 application fee for the business. That should be where the administrative money is taken from.
Okay.
Senator Dames, was that helpful?
Yes.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Dames,
I'd like to do an oral amendment to change that hourly wage from $13 an hour to $11 an hour. I think we get into some of our rural areas, and if we're really interested in getting people trained, and as Senator Tomasoni has said, you know, out in rural Minnesota, we have a lot of jobs that we can't find people to fill, and so I think let's let the market bear the price at what that may be, but I would like to see it set at 11 so we bring more people into the program. So I'd like to do an oral amendment to that.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni, any comment? And where are you at, Senator Dames, in the bill?
Actually, I was just looking at the handout here. I was picking it up off of there. Somebody can help me with where it's at in the bill.
2.32.
Okay.
Okay.
Senator Tomasoni, any comment on Senator Dames?
First year.
Mr. Miller?
First year, so.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Miller?
Senator Dames, in the House version of the bill, they did a very similar amendment, and just for your information on this, they said $10 an hour until either the end of training or 18 months, at which point it would go back to $13 an hour to ensure that the one of the reasons they wanted that is to ensure that these aren't new jobs that are maybe low skill jobs. They want to make sure these are high skill, high training jobs that are being used.
Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, my comment to that would be, and that's great, but I think that we ought to be looking at, even if they're lower skill jobs, if we can get people trained to do those jobs, they'll have opportunities for advancement. I don't know that we want to limit it to certain levels of jobs. I think any training we can do to get any people in the workforce is a real advantage. Cool. And I still would stay with my oral amendment. I realize, what you're saying, the House is done, but we'll have to see how that works out if it gets to a conference committee.
Well, Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, Senator James, I think the reason we got 13 here is because we want people to actually be to know that when they're going into this training and when they're doing the extra education that they might need, that when they come out of the job, they're going to be paid something that they can actually support a family on. And I think when you lower the cost down to $10 an hour, suddenly you're going to be eliminating a whole bunch of people who might be candidates for this because they consider it to be too low a price for them to actually be investing in it. And so I think this is more about trying to find people that are willing to do these jobs and that they see that if they do the investment now, that they'll have the benefit later. Mr. Chairman, I would just oppose Senator Dames' amendment.
Senator,
follow up, Mr. Senator Chair. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. It was not 10. My amendment is not $10. It is $11 an hour. And I just feel that we need to open it up to bring more people on board to get our employment in rural Minnesota up.
And I think, too, though, members, if you continue to read, it's $11 per hour plus benefits by the end of the first year of employment, if that helps at all. But Senator Nelson, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, but before I get to my question, I do see $13 an hour on line 2.32.
Right. He's mm-hmm. amended to
okay.
be 11.
All right. Yes. All right. Were we going to vote on the Dames Amendment? My question is not to the Dames Amendment.
Okay.
Mine is for Senator Tomasoni.
I think we should probably handle Senator Dames' amendment first, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Members have any further discussion on Senator Dames' oral amendment?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, just to make this easier for everybody, let's compromise and make it 12, Senator Dames.
Senator Dames?
I'm going to leave my amendment on the floor. I really think it's an opportunity, and I appreciate your willingness, Senator Tomasoni, but in southwest Minnesota, I think this bill can help us a lot more if we're down in that $11 area than to 12 or 13. So I guess I'd like to leave my amendment there.
Okay. Senator,
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, do you have any thoughts about this?
Still thinking about this. I know this bill does have to go to taxes, but obviously we need to deal with this issue right here. So I know that it's an economic development tool. I'm sympathetic to what Senator Dame said, especially in some of the border communities, but also want to hear what the author thinks, and obviously it's his bill. Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Tomasoni, I'm going to go with you because it's your bill and that's how you feel. So.
Okay, I appreciate that. And I think when you talk about the $13 an hour figure, you're talking about the federal poverty guideline for a family of four. And so I don't think it's unreasonable to be thinking that people are going to get training and get education in order to get a job that's available because they can get paid to support their family. And so I'm sensitive to what Senator Dames is talking about. And let's do this, Senator Dames. Let's leave it at 13, and we'll figure out a way to tailor this for southwestern Minnesota if you want it, and I will be more than happy to do that.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. What you're saying is that at $13 an hour we're going to bring on better jobs and stuff, we're going to bring on higher paid jobs. But the flip side of that coin is in some areas people are just not going to use it. So that's why I'm at where I'm at on this and being kind of stickler on it, because I believe it is a good program. I think you've brought a great program to the table. So I would like to see it expanded and be able to be used by more small employers. And we're going to eliminate some of those smaller employers if we stay at this number. So that's why I'm where I'm at. But thank you very much.
Further discussion on Senator Dames' oral amendment. Do members understand that Senator Dames is moving it on line page 2, line 2.32, we would strike 13 and insert 11. On the Dames motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No. No.
The motion does not prevail. Senator Tomasoni, are members any further discussion? Senator Nelson, back to your question. I'm sorry.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni, I'm wondering if you can talk to me a little bit about the financing. I understand that there's a couple options. One could be a grant from DEED directly to the employer, and one could be a tax credit. So I understand the two methods, but I don't see a fiscal note here. Have you talked about the cost involved in this program, and maybe I don't see it in my packet.
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, the cost of the program is capped at the $20 million. This is a tax benefit that goes to the companies, so we're capping it at the $20 million over the biennium. The reason we included the grant provision is there are some small companies, to Senator Dames' point, there are some small companies who maybe don't have the tax expertise that would be required of this. In those cases, we're allowing them to elect to take a grant from DEED. They would only get 90% of the money they would otherwise be entitled to. But what would happen then is Department of Revenue would hold on to the tax withholdings of the employees again, send them to DEED. DEED would just cut a check to the business, and that would be that. They wouldn't have to go through revenue and fill their taxes out and do anything. It's more in line with the people who run their taxes through their business taxes through their personal taxes. It gives them an option that's a little easier.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the $20 million includes both mechanisms, whether it is the tax credit or the DEED grant, are both encompassed under the $20
million. Mr. Chair, right. Senator Nelson, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, then do we have to carry that in the tax bill?
Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonoff, I would think if this is going to be figured out in the tax committee, yes.
Okay.
And Senator Bonoff, it has been requested, and it will be, if it passes here favorably, referred to the tax committee.
Okay.
Further discussion on Senate File 240. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 240? If not, Senator Bonoff, would you like to make a motion that Senate File 240 is amended to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Thomas.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Champion, Senate File 840 is next on the agenda. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for taking the time to listen to Senate File 840. Mr. Chair, this bill essentially would allow caregivers to use the sick leave already provided by their employers to care for family members who need it. This issue affects an increasing number of Minnesotans as our population ages. Caregivers in Minnesota need the ability to balance the demands of caring for family members with the responsibilities at work. Allowing workers to use their sick time for caregiving is a small but needed support. People who need care need their family members. When a loved one is involved in care for a chronic condition, outcomes improve, care less costly, and people are able to remain in their homes longer. The state of Minnesota, which we understand will benefit from this bill, as it will enable caregivers to remain in the workforce longer, allowing them to retain health benefits and income and continue to be contributors to our economy and tax base. This bill is not, and I repeat, this bill is not a burden to employers. It is a benefit. The caregiver sick leave bill would guarantee that employers are able to use sick time already offered by their employer, but would not require employers to offer any additional benefits. Employees' retention will improve as caregivers will not have to choose between their jobs and their duty to their families and will not have to be replaced. With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to just briefly go through the bill, and then we also have an amendment that I'd like to have someone take as an author's amendment. If you look at, Mr. Chair, 1.88, specifically 1.9, it just increases an employee may, this is permissive, use personal sick leave benefits provided by the employer for absences due to an illness of or injury to the employee's minor or adult. That's added along with spouse, sibling, parent, grandparent, or step-parent for reasonable periods of time. You see at line 1.19 through 1.22, the amendment will clean up this language. It will simply say that this section does not prevent an employer from providing greater sick leave benefits than are provided for under this section, and there will be a period, and the rest of line 1.20 would be stricken, as would lines 1.21 and 1.22. Mr. Chair, with that, I just want to make sure that I reiterate to the committee that this does not force an employer to provide paid sick leave if that is something that the employer does not provide. So anything contrary to that, to the statement that I'm making, would be incorrect. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I have a testifier from the Alzheimer's Association that would like to testify.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is David Foster. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm a caregiver. I take care of my wife, Linda, who is a person with Alzheimer's disease. I'm also a full-time employee of a large software company. I'm a board member and chairman of the Public Policy Committee at the Alzheimer's Association. I'm here today to express the full support of the association for Senate File 840. This bill would allow caregivers to respond to short-term immediate needs, such as doctor's appointments or a crisis that arises from a chronic condition such as Alzheimer's, heart disease, or diabetes. My wife, Linda, started to have trouble with her job at around 2001 time frame. She was having trouble completing tasks. She was having personality conflicts with her boss. At the time, I told her that it was time to retire. She was a legal secretary, and I felt it was probably a good idea for her to step down. We didn't realize until about 2 years later that the reason she'd been having problems was that she had young-onset Alzheimer's disease, which was diagnosed at that time. She was 53 years old then. Today she's 63. She's totally disabled. She lives in a residential facility in Bloomington. I still take care of her as best I can. From 2003 to 2007, I took care of Linda alone in our home. This was a time, as for many families in this situation, a time of isolation and deep emotional difficulty. And also a time when the practical jobs of taking care of someone gradually transitioned from her to me. So she stopped being able to do the daily tasks involved in taking care of a home. This culminated in a crisis, as so often happens. Linda had a seizure, which is a very typical symptom of Alzheimer's. She fell in our bedroom, broke her foot, and was hospitalized and then put in a wheelchair for a few weeks. This was the first of several hospitalizations. This is, again, a very typical progress of the disease, where you reach a level of stable behavior. You think everything is being handled, and then all of a sudden a crisis occurs that kind of throws everything up in the air and you start over. Families have to deal with this all the time. And the crisis then often leads to a decline in cognitive function and a recalculation of all of the practical and logistical tasks that you've been handling. All of this time I was working full-time, and so I always felt that I was dodging bullets and kind of flying under the radar, trying to keep both a full-time job and a full-time caregiver job going at the same time. Sometimes during this period, I would put my wife to bed at, say, 7 or 8 o'clock at night. I would go back to work in the other room until 11 and then come to bed myself. It was a very exhausting routine. Alzheimer's is a family disease, and the stories of many caregivers are the same as this. So a person with the disease has limited ability to take care of themselves, so their crisis becomes a crisis for the entire family. Many of us need to take care of our loved ones, both because we love them, but also for financial reasons. Later in the disease, the financial burden of long-term care begins to loom and people start to run out of money. And so they really need to keep working in order to support their loved one. So I speak here today not only for myself, but for 230,000 other caregivers in the state of Minnesota, and for my friends that I've met through this community, people like my friend Dave, who still takes care of his wife 10 years later because he loves her, but also because he cannot afford the expense of quality long-term care for her. My friend Laura, who runs home from work every day at noon to check her mother's mailbox to make sure that her mother isn't giving money to scammers. For my friend Sarah, who happens to be here today. I didn't know she was going to be here. Sarah juggles her full-time job and taking care of her husband to the point where she's too tired to come to our support group meetings. And so I strongly encourage you to support this bill. It's a small step to give relief to this large community of caregivers at a very small expense. These are people who contribute millions of dollars of unpaid care to Minnesota every year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Foster, for sharing your story. We know these are important issues. I know that Senator Nelson had worked hard on that provision, certainly. So thank you for all you do.
And, Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
Due to time, there are two other testifiers that's on the agenda, but they understand that time is of the essence, and they just we could just acknowledge that they are here and would be willing to testify in the event the committee wanted or needed to hear their testimony. But with that, we would stand for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Champion. We appreciate that, as it is a busy time, but we appreciate their willingness to be here today. Members, do we have any discussion? We need to act on the A1 amendment that would delete everything after section on line 120 till the end of the bill. Senator.
I'll offer the A1.
Senator Nelson will offer the A1 amendment. Further discussion on the amendment, members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Root.
Senator Sparks and Senator Campion, I just want to thank you for bringing this forward. I also am a caregiver. I have taken care of my parents who are, I just lost my papa, but 96 and 97. And it is a hard juggling act, and it's something you do every day, every minute of every day, thinking of that person that you're taking care of before you think of yourself. So thank you for what you do for your wife, and thank you, Senator, for bringing this forward.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator. And thank you for all that you do, because I understand the enormous burden but love that is shown through caring for a loved one.
Okay. Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Champion. I do thank you for bringing this bill. We know particularly in all areas, but particularly in Alzheimer's, which is increasing so dramatically as our generation ages. You know, a lot of the attention has turned to the caregivers because the health of the caregivers and the well-being of the caregivers can help that Alzheimer's patient stay in their home for a longer period of time. I think and that can delay the placement in a memory care unit. And so I think bringing this to our attention and making it an option for those who have this coverage already to be able to use it for caregivers, I think, is an important piece in helping men and women across the state who are dealing with this issue to be able to access that. So I want to thank you for bringing this today. I think it's an important piece of legislation.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator. And I just want to note that the Board of Aging also supports this bill, as does the Wilder Foundation and others as well, but I just didn't want to fail to mention them.
Thank you, Senator Champion. Senator Nelson, I did want to acknowledge, because I know that you worked very hard on the Alzheimer's piece, and I think hopefully this will include them as well. So thank you for your work on that.
Actually,
Senator Nelson.
Actually, it does. And so this bill does encompass Senate File 198, which was the bill I introduced specifically to Alzheimer's, and I think certainly to have it be applicable to all caregivers is certainly a good direction. So thank you.
Senator Nelson, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, and I would move a Senate File 840.
Senator Nelson moves that Senate File 840 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee.
Senator Dietzick, Senate File 735 is next on the list. Senator Dietzick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Before you for your consideration is Senate File 735, the Collaborative and Dispute Resolution Program at the Bureau of Mediation Services. I have a delete all authors amendment that I believe is being handed out. We all want government to be cost-effective, and this program will save time and money and help our local communities. It will help one-on-one disputes in our communities with mediation served by 9 already existing certified nonprofits throughout the state that utilize trained and committed volunteers. It could also help with public policy disputes. The Pioneer Press ran a story the last few days about water issues, groundwater issues, and how it is impacting White Bear Lake, Marshall, Minnesota, and Fairmont, Minnesota. Neighbors around White Bear Lake have already sued the DNR over these water issues. I hope other water issues in Minnesota never end up in court, but as more wells dry up, mediation may be a cost-effective solution to resolve these issues. The collaborative dispute resolution process can build a consensus solution that lasts. I'm honored to have former Senator Roger Moe with us here today. He was Senate Majority Leader for 22 years, and his vast legislative experience, he will tell you that he thinks this collaborative dispute resolution bill may be a better way of resolving our issues. I also have with me today Kermit Buhlman, head of the Conflict Resolution Center, to talk a bit on the community mediation process. Janet Collins is a volunteer mediator, and she's in the audience, and she may or may not speak on her experience working with people. And then Bureau of Mediation Services Commissioner Josh Tilson is here to answer any questions. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Buhlman.
Senator Dietzick, maybe before we go too far, let's adopt the A1 Authors Amendment. I know that this has been a work in progress, and I think maybe that would be a good thing to do. And thank you. I know that the bills have been changed recently, but yes. Senator Bonhoff, would you be willing to offer the A1 Authors Amendment? Okay. All those in favor of the A1 Authors Amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, members. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carmeet Bowman. I'm the Executive Director of the Conflict Resolution Center in Minneapolis, and I'm the Chair-elect of the National Association for Community Mediation. Investing in community mediation programs means leveraging the workforce of hundreds of community volunteers to handle cases that otherwise clog our government and law enforcement entities and courts. Community mediators teach, model, and promote important life skills that help people succeed in jobs, in neighborhoods, and in family and other relationships. Community mediation programs are small entities with a big impact. Usually there are only 1 or 2 staff people in these programs. The funding is needed to coordinate and train the volunteers to do the work. These nonprofits leverage the other funding sources, and with this relatively small amount of funding, these tiny nonprofit structures can support the volunteers to address crises in employment, in housing, neighborhood, and families. The grants component of the bill will support the 9 existing programs, each of whom have anywhere from a quarter-time staff person to 3 staff members. Yet, with the help of volunteers, they serve over 28,000 people each year. Let me give you an example. In Hennepin County Housing Court, community mediators mediated 6,918 cases in a 5-year period from 2006 to 2011. They had a 79% settlement rate, which means that 5,465 cases didn't have to go to court, and each trial requires judicial officer and court staffing expense that must be funded by the state. These cases were settled quickly, effectively, and inexpensively without the need for state government expense. According to Massachusetts legislative study, for every dollar spent, there is a $4.48 return on state investment through leverages resources leveraged and cost savings. Also, a study in Maryland found that each time a citizen calls the police, the city incurs a cost of anywhere from $25 to $195. When mediation is used as an alternative, the city saves this amount of money. Our problem is there has been an underutilization of this cost-effective public service. This is especially true in Greater Minnesota, where regional disparity in the quantity and quality of service is a significant issue. The states that most significantly take advantage of ADR have a statewide coordinated effort, such as we are proposing here through the Bureau of Mediation Services. I'd like now to introduce Janet Collins, who is one of our thousands of volunteer mediators across the state, just to talk a little bit about why she spends her time doing this work. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bullman. Ms. Collins, welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you. I'm Janet Collins. I've been mediating and volunteering for community mediation programs for about 10 years. I think this is incredibly important and impactful work. When I meet with people, they might be business owners, they might be neighbors, they might be parents, parents and children, they might be employers and employees, landlord tenants. In every case, people are angry, sad, vulnerable, confused, and quite often they are self-absorbed. We are definitely not at our best when we are in conflict. So I sit down with people, and I don't judge their circumstances, and I don't judge their behavior. It is my job to help them have a much more productive conversation than they can have on their own. Once people really, truly get listened to, they calm down. And when people are calmer, and this happens, sometimes the facts haven't even changed. They just got listened to. They feel calmer. Suddenly, they can think better. They can see outside themselves more. They're more likely to see somebody else's perspective. And actually, they have a better chance of making really good decisions on their own behalf because it's based on being calm as opposed to upset. I watch people go from seeing each other as evil and monsters to seeing each other as human again. It's an incredible honor for me to do this work. I support this bill. I hope you support this bill so that mediation can be available all over the state and actually in more arenas. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Collins.
And then we have Senator Mull.
Okay. Before that, Senator Bonoff, I might have a question or comment. Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Collins, we bumped into each other in the hallway, and I just have to say that we grew up in the same neighborhood and haven't seen each other since we were kids, so it's a pleasure to see her here. But I did have a question that I asked her, and I got the answer to, and I thought the answer might be something the committee might want to hear as well. And that was, I was concerned when I heard about this bill that we could possibly be opening the door to have mediators be trying to resolve domestic disputes, which I get quite concerned about because of the potential for gun violence, unexpected. You know, you read about all the time where a police officer has been called in on a dispute, and it turns out to be a violent issue. And so I learned that this...
There's a statute, 494.
Ms. Collins?
Sorry.
Thank you. Okay. Yes.
I interrupted you.
No.
Okay. I think my understanding is that there's a... Mr. Chair, there is a statute. It's 494, and it actually prohibits community mediation centers from taking on cases of domestic violence. We have screeners who screen for that, and it is something that we want everybody to be safe, us as well as the parties.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Collins, have you ever been in a situation where you felt physically threatened in your mediation service?
No, never.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bonoff. That was helpful. Senator Moe, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Roger Moe, and I'm here basically in my role. I'm an advisor to a group of Humphrey Fellows. Been working on a project called Minnesota Solutions, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. About 15 years ago, I joined a national nonprofit board called the Policy Consensus Initiative, and it's been a great experience for me because I've had an opportunity to sit with practitioners and folks who watch how you resolve conflict or how you set up planning processes to resolve issues. And hopefully I've learned a few things from really skilled people. One of the chairs of the committee was a former governor of Oregon, John Kitzhaber, who now is back as governor of Oregon. And while he was governor during his first time, he created a system called Oregon Solutions. And it basically is a process of engaging citizens on a particular subject or topic. More often than not, it's natural resources, transportation, urban planning, things like that. And a process that that is designed, and what I've come to the conclusion on all of this and why I think it makes a great deal of sense, because I sat where you sit, and whether you've been here a year or have the good fortune to serve as many years as I did, sometime in that process, you're going to look at a bill and you're going to say, what in the world is this thing doing here? It shouldn't have been here. We shouldn't be dealing with this. This should have been resolved at some different level, and it could have been resolved probably locally. And so I believe in these processes of engaging people to help them try to resolve their problems in lieu of the legislature or in lieu of the courts. And these processes have been proven to work. I would encourage you, if you want to take a look at go on YouTube and just type in policy consensus, and you'll see example after example around this country where legislators who have used their own power to convene to bring people together through a process of kind of collaborative arrangements to, number one, kind of set out a goal, work towards a consensus on that goal. And it's been a very successful process, and you'll see example after example. It doesn't work all the time, but I think it's a good way of engaging people to help solve their own problems. Another part of it, with all due respect to the political parties, by engaging people in a process like that to resolve their differences and to come forward with a solution, it has a much longer standing than a process where if you're 51%, you have control today, but maybe tomorrow you don't have 51%. It has a much longer standing and enduring part of the process. So with that, I hope someday we have Minnesota Solutions, because I think it's a way of engaging citizens, and perhaps this might be a way of helping move that along. So I encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Moll.
Are there any questions?
Senator Dietzick, would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 735? Sir? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dietzick, is there maybe one of your testifiers could give us a little bit of history on the mediation process as it stands now? I believe there's mediation centers in the state, perhaps, and where are those? And what's the current appropriation? And I think this bill might expand the scope, if I understand it correctly, of mediation. And maybe if you could talk about that a little bit.
Ms. Collins?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this is Carmeet Bowman, and I'd be happy to address that question. So there are currently 9 community mediation programs across the state. They generally have, about 3/4 time staff person, no other staff. Most of the state is not covered by a community mediation program. Hennepin County has 2. Anoka has 1. Ramsey County has a very small one. Duluth has 1, and a couple in southern Minnesota. So that's about it. Most of them have very, very little funding, so they really are not serving their counties to the extent that they would like to. And this bill would fund those programs to be able to serve their counties more robustly, plus serve other neighboring counties. And it is the intention of the bill to have every citizen of the state of Minnesota have access to a community mediation program.
Thank you,
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am aware of the community mediation program in Olmsted County, and it's particularly, in fact, Senator Moe, one of our colleagues, former Chief Justice Sandy Keith, actually, is very involved with our community mediation. And so I'm aware of how effective this is in family law issues. And I think, I'm not sure, but I think that might be the only area that's covered in Olmsted County. I'm not exactly clear on that. But can you tell me, does this expand the scope then? In other words, does this bill expand the scope of what type of issues can be resolved through this process? And then also talk about the financial appropriation. Here it's $250,000 in the bill, in Senator Dietzick's bill, but what is it currently?
So it does not expand the scope. We have a statute 494 that says what community mediation programs can and cannot do, and we would continue to be governed by 494. So it would just provide an appropriation that that would enable us to really do more and go beyond the judicial realm to also do community work. So neighbor-to-neighbor kinds of work, certain kinds of family cases, employment cases, business, restorative justice, work in schools. So very large scope of things that we already do, but we would still be governed by Minnesota Statute 494.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Senator Dietzick, do you happen to know what the current funding is for this program?
So currently there is funding through the judiciary for all nine programs, and that's $99,000. So nine of us split $99,000. That's a program that's just in the judiciary, so anything that would otherwise go to court. The appropriation that we're asking for here would be for all the community cases, things that are not in the judicial realm, so more community-oriented kinds of cases.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Senator Nelson.
So my question is, we've got these nine centers, these programs, that we know are working very well with the judicial issues. I'm wondering if it might be wise to do some sort of a pilot in this expansion. In other words, I think the bill here is looking to expand into doing a lot of other type of mediation as well. We have great results so far, but it would be nice to see if I can't envision how neighbor-to-neighbor mediation is going to work, or I can't quite vision how this program would be taken into the schools. And so I'm just I had thought about offering an amendment, but I won't. But I will just offer my comments for Senator Dietzick to consider as the bill moves forward, that maybe looking at looking at maybe some sort of a pilot site for this new expanded, maybe scope was the wrong word, but it looks like doing something a little bit different, expanding the mission, so to speak, and looking at it maybe on a smaller scale, just to make sure it's going to work, because we know we have a program that's working now, and before we increase the funding, 7.5 times as much funding, maybe we should make sure that the new areas that we want to fund are actually going to be as successful as what you're doing right now. So just a comment to consider as you go forward.
Senator Dietzick, you want to respond?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Nelson. I think that's a good idea. I think we need to. I know they have been working on this and thinking about it, and so I will take your thoughts. And I think that's good, because we do want to succeed, and we do want this to succeed. And so I think we need to, rather than grow too large, I think we want to be thoughtful and methodical, and so that everybody succeeds, because the bill is to help everybody succeed, and so we wouldn't want to overwhelm some or, again, miss certain areas. And so thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Do you have other testifiers, Senator Dietzick?
We have the Commissioner of Bureau of Mediation Services here, if anybody has any questions for him.
Any questions that we would desire to have the commissioner come to the hearing table? Seeing no questions, I don't think that'll be necessary. Mr. Rick Heller, would you like to come to the table and testify, please?
Thank you, Senator, Chair,
Would you state your name for the record, sir?
Yes, my name is Rick Heller. I currently unofficially represent two unidentified or recognized groups in Minnesota statute. They're called disabled and twice exceptional. I come here, I guess it has to do with special education, as I look at mediation and think back about how successful the Department of Education is with their mediation. I thought I'd express that. Perhaps maybe sometimes we can't always say complaints that are filed and due before having a resolution meeting, which sometimes can include that. Some people don't like adversarialness, but I do like mediation perhaps because you can get resolve and hopefully reconciliation ultimately. I just sort of mentioned that the print disabled are found in the federal law. You'll find that in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008, only next to one other disabled learner, or I should say able learner, that's blind. I would also like to express concern as private agencies use grant monies. If everyone could go to page 3.2 or line 3.2, I guess it's on page 3 then, talks about guidelines that are going to be adopted by court administrators. I like to know specific individuals here or their analysts if private agencies use state money that they will follow the guidelines according to Minnesota Statute 16, which has to do with governance and technology standards. As we all know, Minnesota in 2009 adopted standards that all state websites, with the exception of the Capitol, and I believe the governor's office, is exempt regarding 2.0 web accessibility and 508 compliant. So the question again is, when private agencies apply for grants, will they comply to Minnesota Chapter 16 as it relates to making their documents fully accessible for the print disabled and blind? I'm open to questions, and I would like to have an answer for that today if possible, if not in the future.
Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would assume, and I would also like to know, because I agree with the gentleman, that, but I would assume that we do, for the most part. I know we exempt ourselves a lot of times, just like the U.S. Senate and U.S. House do, but I believe we should follow our own rules. So I am assuming that agencies do follow state and federal laws, and actually organizations that apply and receive grants, I believe, are required to follow state and federal law.
The only thing I have to ask, are there direct policies currently in place that support this? I cannot find any, including what's in the Department of Education. They deny me access to that information when I find the PACER Center using dipping into the trough for special education funding and at-risk students. They don't want to answer me. So I would like to know that I think it's appropriate that this committee and the public at large, including the print disabled and blind, know for engagement and participation an application if this is correct or not, because I can't get an answer from some of the departments. And it's hard to know, so I can think at a higher level. So we can synthesize this in an integrated way, since we're going to be asking private and public agencies that dip into the trough, will they be compliant with our own standards, since we're requiring multiple state agencies to meet those standards on accessibility. And since 21st century skills are part of that, including those that are English language learners, and Governor's Bill 1151 on page 11 and 12, you will find twice exceptional language and language learners as proposed both in the Senate file and House file.
And Mr. Heller, we certainly appreciate your testimony. I think we're maybe veering a little away from this bill, but I would suggest that maybe you visit with a counselor or somebody like that here. We don't have the answers today for that, but maybe we can get them for you. So I thank you for your testimony.
I prefer that that the committee chair or one of its members asked a question, because this is a public question, not a personal question. I believe that I could be copied, that it would be wonderful. But if any party that sits in this committee is interested in that, I ask that they be sent the correspondence, I'd be copied it, because what happens is this is a case-by-case basis. I become isolated, and the public at large do not find out about it. I'd appreciate that you reconsider.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Heller. Any other testifiers that want to testify on Senator Dietzick's bill, Senate File 735? Hearing no other testifiers, is there any further discussion on Senate File 735? There being no further discussion, Senator Bonhoff, would you be willing to move the bill?
I would.
Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate File 735, as recommended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries. The next bill will be Senate File 491. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I'd like to move Senate File 491.
Senator Nelson moves Senate File 491. Go ahead, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 491 is a project to supply work supports to high-functioning autism and Asperger's young adults. This bill is actually the people in this committee who were in this committee last year would have heard this bill last year as well. And it came out of my experience with my intern here in the Minnesota Senate in 2011. I had a young man interning for me who had Asperger's syndrome, and he came with work supports that helped prepare him to work in my Senate office. And what I found was that he was an excellent worker. He did a great job. And I've learned that autism spectrum disorder has grown significantly since the late 90s. And what we have seen is that these young men and women, these young students who have had support while they're in school, maybe through an IEP, are graduating, and they could be workers, independent workers in our society, in our world, if there were some of that support to help them become those independent workers. And that was the intent of this bill. And I have a couple testifiers with me today that I'll let them discuss the importance of this bill and the growth in autism in our society. And so perhaps I could turn that over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
And we'll start with Ms. Walker, if she could introduce herself.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Pat Dunn Walker. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing our bill today. I appreciate you have a busy schedule, and I appreciate you hearing our bill. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm here to tell you about Bill 491, Employment and Independent Living Services for People with Asperger's and High-Functioning Autism and Related Conditions. I myself am a parent of an almost 18-year-old young man with Asperger's syndrome. He's a very intelligent young man and does well in school. We're worried about him when he gets out of high school. But I'm also the co-facilitator of Social Odyssey with another parent, Susan Powers. Social Odyssey is a support and advocacy group for people affected by high-functioning autism and Asperger's syndrome. For those of you not familiar with Asperger's and high-functioning autism, these individuals are highly intelligent, honest, hardworking, and loyal. And as Senator Nelson said, they are great workers. With support, they can become excellent employees and citizens. However, they have some challenges. For example, lack of social understanding and difficulty with organizational skills, which are critical to educational and job success. During their school years, my son and others like him do get the support they need and are successful. Unfortunately, after high school, these supports do drop off and they have to navigate the workforce on their own. The unemployment rate for persons with these conditions, and this is the unemployment rate, not the underemployment rate, but the unemployment rate is 60% to 70%. These young adults can and do wind up on the downside of the law and legal system, and it doesn't have to be this way. In January of 2012, our community of parents, young adults, held a forum to address how we could meet the needs of these young adults with so much potential. We invited our parents, our individuals with autism, community organizers, and our legislators, such as Senator Nelson, to our forum. The conference room at SEMCEL, where the forum was held, was packed. At the end of this two-hour session, Representative Kim Norton volunteered to write this bill. This bill is a bipartisan bill supported by both sides of the aisle, authored by both sides of the aisle. Bill 491, which is a pilot program, would provide the supports necessary for job support. This bill would help with training for understanding the social aspects of pre-employment, also known as job hunting. It also provides for maintaining employment and interacting in the workplace. This pilot program would provide ongoing employment supports and independent living services necessary to secure, maintain, and advance in employment and to promote an individual's self-sufficiency and ultimately financial independence. I would now like to turn the floor or the microphone over to Louis Burchard, who will now offer further testimony as a person with Asperger's on how this bill would help our community. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak in favor of Bill 491.
Thank you, Ms. Dunwalker and Mr. Burchard. If you would like to state your name and
My name is Louis Burchard. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I come here today to support Bill SF-491 as a person with autism, as well as the director of the Social Support Group for Adults with Autism in Rochester. I find that my independence comes from being employed. In fact, because this is such an important issue, I have worked with DEED on the issues of employment and independent living, and am featured on their website as someone with autism who was employed successfully. The success has not come without a price, however. There are many times where the issues I have that are associated with autism have either interfered with my work or resulted in lost opportunities in employment. I graduated from high school before the idea of high-functioning autism was formally known in the United States, so my situation could be summarized as sink or swim. I obtained my current job as a result of being an independent contractor with the employer first, rather than going through the regular interview process, and I am thankful that my present managers work past the issues of autism and see what I have to offer the company. The situation, unfortunately, is not the same with my peers. I see that most of them are neither employed nor independent. I have seen the statistics that say the employment rate is low for our population, but it is hard to know how many adults have high-functioning autism, so I can't give firm numbers. It has been suggested that the unemployment rate for high-functioning autistic people runs as high as 60 to 70%, but when you factor in the underemployment rate, those in jobs that are beneath their skills, it goes up to 80 to 90%. Many have given up and instead opted for Social Security. This is sad because the government spends a ton of money in K-12 education working with our population, and that at 18 to 21, the support is taken away and there's no place for our population to turn to, when with a little push we can make a big difference and the government could get a return on the money it's spent on education. This is especially true for those whose IQ is above 80, which is above the level for funding due to cognitive delay. The problem is especially acute in outstate Minnesota, where there are not as many social workers and programs that understand the needs of a person with high-functioning autism. This pilot program will help in working with our population to see what works in getting us employed and independent. My hope is that we can learn from this and apply it statewide, because I see this as a Minnesota problem, not just a local problem to Rochester or Olmsted County. I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee for the opportunity to speak on Bill SF-491, and I'm willing to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Bouchard. Committee, have any questions for Mr. Bouchard? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to see if Dr. Cheryl Grassi is here. I know she had called my office today and was going to try to attend, but I think our testifiers have given a great description of why this project is needed. Those of you who were listening to NPR this morning might have heard a report that 1 out of 50 students in the U.S. has autism. So it's growing. And committee members, I have a handout for you from Dr. Grassi, which you can read about some of those statistics. But as policymakers, I'd like to draw your attention to the back page, which shows the graph. A picture is worth 1,000 words. And if you look at this graph and you see the incidence of autism and how it has spiked dramatically since the late 1900s or the 1990s and 2000. These are the kids now that are now in their 20, 22 that have left school and need these work support so that they can be productive members in our society. I will say I want to thank my co-authors, Senator Bonoff, Senator Tomasoni, Senator Rest, Senator Senjum. This is a great bipartisan bill. We saw it in the Jobs Committee last year, or actually in 2011 as well. I do want to clarify for the committee that there's a small appropriation with this, Mr. Chair, so I'm thinking you'll need to go to finance. It's a $68,000 ask for deed for a one-time grant. It's for a pilot project in Olmsted County, where we have the support of Social Odyssey and other community resources in place. We do think, however, though, this may, if you think about those incident numbers, this pilot, if successful, may prove to be a program that could be beneficial statewide. But we are starting small just to make sure that we do think it's something, though, that can be scaled statewide.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Eakin?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Nelson. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a great idea, and we need to – I think some great points were made here about the importance of capitalizing on this untapped resource that we have available, and you mentioned about the investments that have already been made in taking advantage of those investments and providing a better quality of life for those that are suffering from autism. I was just struck by, though, the increasing rate in autism, and wondering if there's what accounts for that. I know there's probably no definitive answer to that, but are there studies that you're aware of that indicate what's resulting in this increase, and if some of it may be a result of just better diagnosis, maybe just diagnosing more, that maybe we've always had a higher rate but just never known it. I was just wondering, because I think it's important if we maybe want to look at addressing some of the root causes, if there's anything that can be done there.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson?
Thank you. Senator Eakin. I think you brought up a very good question, and that was my question, too, as I looked at that dramatic chart. Why have we seen such an increase? I don't know that there are definitive answers yet. I'm going to let the experts beside me speak to that. I will say there was a change in the DSMV, I think that's the initials, 4, that may have changed somewhat but I think it goes to better identifying, perhaps, what may have existed before, but we were unsure. But I would like to have my experts discuss that. Or perhaps the executive director, Ms. Dolly Molly, do you have any comments on why we have the increase? Ms. Dolly Molly?
Would you come to the table, ma'am, and introduce yourself for the record?
I think predominantly.
Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes. I am Vicki Dolly Molly with the Southeastern Minnesota Center for Independent Living in Rochester. I think of all the explanations that there could be for an increase in autism spectrum disorders, probably the number one is early diagnosis of this condition and the related conditions of it. It's been prevalent, you know, for years and years. And as you heard Lewis talk, when he was in school, it was not something that was really known, or the conditions were not such and specified that they could be, the taxonomy of those conditions could be put into one grouping as to what this disorder might be. So I really do think it's really early intervention and early diagnosis of certain conditions.
Thank you, ma'am.
What do you think?
Mr. Chair, I believe Lewis has a few comments to answer the Senator Egan's question.
My comment go along with Ms. Dolly Molly's is that I graduated high school in 1993 and DSM-IV was released in 1994. So I think it's always been there. There have always been adults. The research work on high-functioning autism has been going on since Hans Asperger's work in 1944. Unfortunately, because his work was done in Nazi Germany, it was ignored until the 1980s.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, do you have further testifiers?
No, I don't, Mr. Chair. I'd like to... are there other questions?
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, does the Department of Health or Department of Health and Human Services, I always get confused what has jurisdiction over what, but are they aware of what you're proposing, and do you find that they're also working on this issue? I mean, I think this is a growing concern, and so I appreciate that you're bringing forth a pilot, but I also am looking at whether or not there's a commitment on behalf of our agencies to tackle this.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. Those are very good questions. A couple things. We are working with the Department of Deed, which is the economic piece of it. But I will tell you that if you might recall that in 2012 we had the Minnesota Autism Task Force report to Governor Dayton. You might have been on that task force. And this sounds very familiar to you because it fits into that transition to adulthood.
Right.
So that's really what this is dealing with. And Senator Bonhoff, I think you are exactly right. This is only a pilot. This is a one-year appropriation. I do think we're going to have to scale this to a much larger capacity because the need is definitely there. So, Senator Bonhoff, if you would like to increase funding on this bill dramatically, we definitely will scale it to statewide. I would accept that as a friendly amendment.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Nelson, Bonhoff. Maybe some of that money that's going into the exchange could be shared with, you know, this approach.
I think that's a marvelous idea, Senator Bonhoff.
Senator Nelson, do you have any other testifiers?
No, I don't, Mr. Chair.
Members have any other questions for Senator Nelson? Mr. Heller, I'm not going to have you come at the table at this time because, as I understand, your questions are pretty much what we had in the last one, and so we don't have any new answers for you. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. I'm not sure if this is something that needs to be re-referred to finance, I would assume.
Yes, it does, ma'am.
Okay. That would be my motion then to... recommend passage and re-refer to finance.
Senator Nelson renews her motion that Senate File 491 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion on Senate File 491? Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Welcome, Senator Sparks. We have Senate File 1160 before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1160 will be the Omnibus Agriculture Policy Bill. I do have the A3 amendment that I think either will be handed out, pardon me, or should be in members' packets. This amendment represents the agriculture policy and technical changes that we had heard and discussed in committee this session that I believe there is general agreement upon. I sent this language to each of you and hope that you had an opportunity to look at it over. However, I think before we take any action, I would like to ask Senate Counsel, Mr. Knopf, to walk through the provisions of the A3 for us so that everyone is clear as to what is contained in this language as well as the members of the audience. And with that, if Mr. Knopf is ready, I would yield to him.
Mr. Knopf, please.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll just go briefly through each section of the bill, and I'll probably go pretty quick. If you have any questions, let me know or slow me down. The first section, that deals with the policy of the first article is policy and technical changes. The first section you saw, this was in the original Senate File 1160 that the committee already heard. So is Section 2, bulk pesticide storage. I won't spend a lot of time since these were discussed pretty well in committee. Section 3, Section 4, Section 5, these are the pesticide provisions that were in. Same with Section 6 on the no fee. That was in the department's original bill. Section 7, this was a bill of Senator Marty's, and this is the provision as it was amended in committee. There are two sections. You'll see one at the end of the of this article also, but Section 7 deals with the approving and evaluating basically kind of beefing up the training program for the pesticide education and training. And then Mr. Chair and members, Section 8 was also the technical changes on the offered for sale for the under the pesticide law. These were again discussed at Sections 8, 9, 10, 11, Section 12, Section 13 was part of that. Section 14 deals with the organic agriculture duties of the commissioner, and this is the same identical language that was in the in 1160 when you heard the first time it was part of the department's request. Section 15, this was also in here. This is the extension of the Next Gen Energy Board for another year. Section 16, these are the agri grants. Agriculture growth and research and investment grants. That is as it was. Section 17 was part of the original bill with the restructured loan, where it says on 11.14 without prepayment penalty, so it will allow the commissioner to or the RFA to charge a prepayment penalty. Section 18, this was from Senator Sparks' bill the other day, dealing with the Agriculture Education Leadership Council Board, MILSI, I think is people commonly refer to it, and this is extending that for another 5 years. Section 19 and 20 deal with the bond requirements for grain warehouse operators and grain buyers. That was in the original bill and discussed in committee. Section 21 was also in the committee originally. This deals with the gasoline tax law and E85. Section 22, we heard this just on Monday in committee. Senator Sparks sent out 253, although there is a different date than was in the original bill on Section 22. Section 23, this is again from the original bill, and it deals with waste pesticide reporting in 2013, 2014, and 2015. Again, this was discussed in committee when 1160 was originally heard. Section 24, this was part of Senator Marty's bill, Senate File 550, dealing with the pesticide use of the pesticide regulatory account to modify the applicator education and training materials. Section 25, this just deals with trying to keep definitions in alphabetical order, and that was part of the original bill. So was the repealer on Section 26, and the repealer is because if people remember, we were combining restrictions on using a public water supply with also using public waters, and then this is the public waters provision that's being repealed. Article 2 now, this does not include what Senator Sparks bill on the agricultural water quality provisions that were heard the other day on Monday and sent on to state and local, sent on to judiciary. instead, we have the biofuels provision. This is part of Senator Sparks' Senate File 448. There are a couple of additions that I want to point out as we go through. Section 1 is as it was in 448. Section 2 is also as it was. Section 3 is actually Senator Sparks Bill, Senate File 1288, where we're adding biochemical or bio-based chemical to the items that the Next Gen Energy Board will look at for funding. So that was actually in a separate bill. And Section 5 was also part of Senator Sparks' bill. Section 6, as you saw, as it passed out of the committee. Section 7, as it passed out. Same with Section 8. Now, Section 9 is a little different from when it left committee, and I'll try to point out the difference. If you look on 15.28 to 15.31, what this does is it keeps the trigger for ethanol, basically, which conventional biofuel, if you remember, is defined as ethanol from cornstarch. So it keeps the trigger for conventional biofuel, and that was actually removed in this committee, but there was some concern about removing that to go to the maximum amount allowed in a waiver. So that keeps that trigger in. And then if you look on the top of page 16, you can see for other biofuels, it would be a minimum level of 10%. If they go to that, and then if you remember, we have the provisions on 1616 to 1620 that kind of ramp up the use of the advanced biofuels. Section 10, there has been some minor tweaking to Section 10 on the federal clean air waivers, just to match with the changes that were made in Section 9. Same with Section 11, there was some tweaking we needed to do to refer to the proper item in that section. So that's a little bit different, but it just corresponds with the changes. Section 12 is basically identical, except if you look on page, as when it left this committee, it did go to state and local government, and the task force is removed as specified as a task force, and we continue that the commissioners have to work with representatives. Commissioners can form their own task force, so the task force will still be there. It's just not named in the statute. And so that's a little bit different. And then also on 18.22 to 18.23, you'll see there's a new provision that also has the commissioners, along with the task force, look at developing procedures for reporting the amount and type of biofuel that is used. Section 13, the definition for the for biobutanol is the same as when it left. And then the repealer of the E20 minimum requirement on Section 14, that is the same as it left this committee. And Article 3, the noxious weed law, I won't go into any detail. This is as it was heard in committee with some minor tweaks that were offered in amendment to Senator Sparks' bill, the noxious weed law. Otherwise, that is identical as the way the department brought it in, but with the tweaks that were in that amendment. And, Mr. Chair, that's the end of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Any discussion or questions on the A3 amendment at this time?
Mr. Chair, and if I can just say a few words. Again, I just want to thank members for your willingness to work so hard on this provisions that we've previously heard. Mr. Knopf has put a lot of work into it, did a wonderful job explaining it. Many of the provisions were just as we had heard them, but there are two exceptions that I'd just like to touch base on. Then certainly before we move the amendment, I'd be willing to answer any questions, or certainly I think we have people in the audience that could help us. Section 22 is the extension of the farmer lender mediation. I think that we had a wonderful discussion on that the other day, and I would like for us to continue to work on that issue. What I'm offering here is an extension at the current level of $5,000. I know that we had talked about raising that level, but we reduced it to a two-year extension so that we'll be sure to revisit the issue. The other body had already moved that bill at the $5,000 level and passed it a four-year current extension. But I did talk with the chair of the ag policy in the House, and she's willing to take another look at the program. And I think by not moving this to 4 years but for 2 years, that allow us to meet with the stakeholders in the interim and bring back hopefully a bill that we can bring forward next session. The other provision that you'll see changes in is the biofuel section. When the bill left here, I made a commitment to you to keep working on the language to address the concerns in the bill. The language is the result of that work, and the stakeholders reach agreement, and we have addressed the concerns with the language. So, again, I want to thank all those stakeholders that worked hard. I know that wasn't easy, and they did a lot of heavy lifting, but that would be the two major changes other than what we had previously heard. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to discuss the amendment further.
Thank you, Senator Sparks. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Senator Sparks, I just have a small question, but it has to do with the difference between conjunction and consultation with, and that's with the pesticide education and training with the University of Minnesota Extension Services and the MNSCU. I'm just curious, are we taking any, are we putting more power in the agency and taking away some of the conjunction with type agreement? What's the significance of changing those two words? It looks like we're just giving more power to the agency and taking away power from the extension or MNSCU. I'm just curious about the change in words there.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, can you help me where you're at?
I'm so sorry. Page five, the bottom of page five. Section 7, talking about education and training regarding pesticide.
Senator Nelson, Senator Sparks, I am told that this is a provision in statute that was provided to us from, this language was provided from a bill that Senator Marty brought to committee. I'm not sure if Mr. Knock would like to clarify.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty's not here, and when his bill came through the committee, that question wasn't asked. But I think I can speculate a little bit about what that is. I think I can be almost positive that I think I understand. You know, originally, the commissioner and the director of extension. So it said in conjunction, but when you start broadening it to other higher education institutions, doing it in conjunction could become difficult. You know, do they have to meet or do they just? So I think that's why it was changed to consultation. I didn't draft the original bill, but I think it was was in Senator Marty's bill that way. It was in consultation, and I think it's because of the you're broadening the people you're working with.
Thank you. I can accept that.
Thanks, Mr. Knopf.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks. I'm just going to page 2, basically lines 2.21, 2.22, and talks about pesticides may not be stored in any location with an open drain, and I understand that and don't have a problem with that. What I'm concerned with is in my business I get into a lot of machine sheds and shops, and typically what happens on the farm is you have a larger building that is built. You have one section of it that probably is walled off for shop purposes and may have a drain in it, and then in the adjoining portion of the building is where you oftentimes will have a gravel floor and you'll have machine storage, and during the spring that's where seed and chemicals are typically stored out of the weather. And so technically, it's in a building with an open drain. Are we setting up a problem here?
Mr. Chair and
Senator Sparks,
I believe that was part of the department's bill, and we can see if they're here to talk to you. I certainly understand your concern. I know that...
Welcome, sir. If you could state your name for the record.
I'm John Peckham with the Minnesota Department of Ag. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senator Weber, when we're looking at the word, the operative word is any location. We're not necessarily talking about an entire building. So in your example, Senator, the area that doesn't have the drain would be fine for storage of products.
Okay.
Whereas the area that has the drain, which then may go to a septic tank or some other, would be a problem.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Peckham. Mr. Knopf, do you have a suggestion on maybe how to clarify this?
Well, Mr. Chair, and I'm trying to think if there would be open drains that wouldn't be within a room, but you know, it could be any room at any location in a room with an open drain or something to that effect. I'm not sure exactly. I don't know if this is to update it to meet kind of FIFRA standards or whatever. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Peckham.
We would be open to whatever wording would work there. Room may not work the best simply because there's a connotation to what a room is versus a building, pole shed, and that sort of thing. Part of a building, perhaps?
Thank you, Mr. Peckham. Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Peckham, Would it be all right if you would work together with some of the ag groups here and come up with some language, and we could probably amend this in when it gets to the floor? Would you be willing to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Names, absolutely.
If you would do that, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Any other questions at this point? Yes, Senator Names.
Section 5, page 3, Mr. Peckham, I believe it is, could you tell me what's prompting these changes? The present language seems to be working very well, and it seems like we're putting some pretty broad language in here, and I guess my question is, why is this change needed when the current language is working?
Mr. Peckham.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, the current language is somewhat confusing, and that is the whole reason why we wanted to make the change. We feel like if it's consolidated here, it's more clear for people to be able to comply with.
Would you explain in
Senator
what
Dames.
Way, Mr. Chair, a follow-up, would you explain just exactly what you mean by making it clear? In what way are you doing that?
Well,
Mr. Peckham,
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, if we look at the lined out provisions 1 and 2, we've tried to take the language there and basically just combine it and move it into one sentence.
Well, and
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Peckham. That's fine. I'm not so sure that we're really accomplishing anything, but I'll accept what you're saying.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peckham, certainly, just to follow up on that a little bit, to me, there's more ambiguity arising here, because if you have the statement where pesticides or materials contaminated with pesticides could enter ditches, surface water, groundwater, technically, that could be any spot in the field. I mean, because groundwater, I mean, if you have seepage into the ground, et cetera, I mean, if someone took a broad approach to that language, you couldn't do it any place.
Sure. Mr.
Peckham.
Senator Weber, that language actually just comes from the existing language, and certainly there are existing regulations in terms of pesticide labels that govern setbacks and other things. Yeah. So I think the intent here is not to broaden this out to be any part of a field. The intent is those specific areas where filling, cleaning, unloading, or parking, where it's done, where it could enter, as the wording says, ditches, surface water, groundwater, wells, drains, or sewers. So in areas where that is not an issue, then certainly there wouldn't be any problem, any regulatory issue with that.
Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Peckham, I'm not going to introduce an amendment today, but would you be willing to work with the ag groups to kind of clean this up a little bit and make it something that we could agree to?
Mr. Chair. Peckham.
Senator Dames, absolutely.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Bonoff.
I have an amendment. Would this be the right time to offer the amendment, Senator Sparks, or
Mr.
do you want
Chair,
to pass
unless,
this first?
Maybe we could move the A3 amendment, unless there's further questions, and I would certainly entertain your amendment.
Senator Bonner, if it's okay, Senator Sparks moves the A3 amendment. There's no discussion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. And the motion prevails. Senator Bonoff, would you like to offer an amendment?
I do, and I don't know the number of it.
Is it the
Mr. Chair?
It's the A4 amendment.
Okay, good. Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, if you recall, when we actually were hearing Senator Schmidt's bill, where we were talking about the department's commitment to the farm to school program, as well as there were two other programs, and I asked the question, how will we know that you will in fact end up spending the amount that you say in each of those? And so then we had a broader discussion about should there be rider language where we actually put into statute the actual commitment to spend at a certain level. And really the department wants that flexibility in terms of what's important. So as a compromise, I suggested that They just report back to us at the end of each year how much they actually did spend so that we can have an understanding of that. So that's what this amendment does. It simply says that by February 1st each year, the commissioner shall report to the legislature on the allocation among eligible uses and any financial assistance provided under this section.
Thank you, Senator Bonner. Yes, please, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gothier, Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Bonhoff, the department would be fine with that amendment.
Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I thank you, and obviously with the department's blessing, I would view this as a friendly amendment.
Then, right, Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, I just want to also let you know that I was told by council that this would also be at the same time that the next-gen reporting is done also, so it would be fine if it was all rolled together and you don't have to do an extra report.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, thank you. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
And we do a pretty extensive report every February 1st, so we'd be happy to roll this in with that.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Dames.
Senator Bonhoff, is this, did you say for the farm to school?
Yes.
All right. If there's no discussion, further discussion on the A4 amendment, Senator Bonhoff moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. And the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any additional discussion or questions? Senator Sparks?
Pardon me. Mr. Chair, I do have the A5 amendment.
Senator Sparks has offered the A5 amendment.
And while you're passing that out, Mr. Chair, and I can have Mr. Knopf help too, but the A5 amendment is a part of all the work that was put into the biofuel section. Our current statute deals with gasoline, and I think that this just updates it to say biofuel, and Mr. Knopf could maybe go into a further explanation, but I believe that's the intent of this A5 amendment. We certainly want to make sure members have a copy, and hopefully that was a fair...
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, it was brought to my attention that even though that the minimum content requirement would include other biofuels, we may have some restrictions in current law that would not allow gasoline to be mixed with another biofuel. So what this does is it removes the term ethanol in the gasoline provision, basically talking about what can be sold as gasoline in the state. And if you look on 1.7, gasoline that is not blended with ethanol must also comply with volatility requirements. This would also say that any biofuel, I guess I should have gone up to 1.5 too, gasoline that is not blended with biofuel must not be contaminated with water or other impurities. So it basically puts other biofuels the same standard as we have right now for ethanol. But the one that was the most concern was on 1.13 to 1.14, where it says that it shall not be blend gasoline with any oxygenate other than denatured agriculturally derived ethanol, and this would expand that to biofuel. And if you look at 3 on 1.15 to 1.16, it says shall not blend gasoline with other petroleum products that are not gasoline or ethanol. So this would just replace biofuel. There are other sections in this law or the subdivisions that deal with gasoline and ethanol, but that's more how you have to mix it when you're dealing with ethanol. We may need down the road, as other biofuels come on the market, take a longer look at some of these statutes. But at least I think for now, this would make sure that they wouldn't be precluded by this law from being able to blend with gasoline.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Any questions or discussion on the A5 amendment? All right. Seeing none, Senator Sparks moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. And the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Right. There, anyone else like to speak to Senate File 1160 at this time? Senator Dames, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if someone from the department maybe could answer my question here, page 6, line 626, 628. Is giving instructions on the manuals and the examination must include pesticide management practices that discuss prevention of pesticide occurrence in groundwater and surface water of the state. Now, most pesticide labels, in fact, I think all pesticide labels, show required setbacks and things like that for the application of these pesticides. So I'm assuming that this is basically what this manual is also going to be telling us. So my question becomes, if there's a difference between the manual and the label, which one is the applicator, the agriculture producer, supposed to follow?
Welcome, sir. If you could state your name again.
Thank you. I'm Joe Spitzmuller. I'm a manager at the Department of Agriculture. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator. If I understood the question, the labels are the law. That's the standard by which the applicator has to abide.
Thank you. That's what I needed to know, if the labels was going to be the precedent. So thank you.
Okay.
All right. Any additional questions or discussion? All right. Anyone like to testify before or against Senate File 1160? All right. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Sparks, would you like to move the Senate File 1160?
Mr. Chair, yes, and I would just like to thank members for all their hard work, not only today but all session long. I think, again, this committee has proven that they can work together bipartisanly, and certainly the agriculture bill in the past has been that, and that's my hope that we'll continue to do that. Obviously, Senator Dames and Senator Weber, you have my word that we'll continue to work on the drain and the pesticide issue. Hopefully we can bring this to floor for a successful vote. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 1160 as amended be recommended to pass.
Thank you. Well, Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 1160 as amended be recommended to pass. With no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say no. And the motion prevails. All right. Well, thank you, members. That concludes the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee for the day. Thank you. And the committee is adjourned.